Hello and welcome to another episode of Texas State Choirs Today. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Babcock, and we are at the SWACTA convention in Little Rock, Arkansas. And we're very excited to be talking with Dr. Z. Randall Stroop, who is the Director of Choral Activities at Oklahoma State University and is also a world-renowned composer and conductor. Dr. Stroop, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Well, it's my honor. I think this is a really nice idea that you have going here, and I'm happy to be a part of it.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Since our main focus, our main audience is undergraduates, I always like to start with just talking about your undergraduate experience. So where did you go to school? Tell us about your undergraduate experience.
I think my undergraduate experience was, I majored, first of all, in piano and voice. So, which is a little unusual to have a double major. I also had a minor, was in music education, by the way. I took a minor in economics and a minor in German all at one big time.
So you were busy.
I was busy. I still graduated in 4 years, but
wow.
No grass grew underneath my feet.
And what was what institution?
I went to actually Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, Oklahoma
okay.
for undergrad.
Well, and certainly all of those things came together into what your career is.
You know, it really
now.
Did because as a composer, of course, you can't know everything about every instrument, but certainly having a strong knowledge of the piano and a strong knowledge of choral, and I was also a brass player there, so of that part of it. So I felt pretty well-rounded in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Great. And I also, going through your bio and such, you've had some wonderful mentors. Particularly the one that stuck out to me was Margaret Hillis. Margaret Hillis was just, you know, she was one of the very, of course, you know, the very first symphonic choir directors that really, there was just such spark in the music that she made. Tell us a little bit about working with Margaret.
She is an all business conductor. She really was. And I would fly to Wilmette or to Chicago, which is right below Wilmette, once a month. And I would spend 2 days with Margaret, two mornings. I would take the train up to Wilmette to her home. She taught in her office upstairs, and from 9 to 12. And she was at 9 o'clock it started, and exactly 12 o'clock it ended. And we studied all the large works, you know, Brahms Requiem and Carmina Burana and Haydn Creations, and just all those. That's what we did. And in the evening, or the time between the 2 days, I would go back to the hotel, and she would give me her parts to, like, the Haydn Creation or any of the big works that she had herself bowed, and I would copy all those parts. So I have her bowings and her markings on probably 30 large works.
Oh, my goodness.
And so she was kind enough to let me take them overnight, and so I made copies at one of the copy shops there. So, but she was all business, and she would often have visitors in her home. Like one time I remember she had a visitor. She says, "Well, Danny is here." And she said, "One moment." So I looked out the door, and there's Daniel Barenboim standing at her. Yeah, Danny, in her living room, and they talked for a couple of minutes, and then she came back up, and you know, she never said a word about it. She just sat on and kept talking about the score is in front of us. But yeah, she was quite an inspiration. And I had her also come down to Omaha, where I was working at the time, and conducted a concert there for us.
Oh, terrific.
Yeah.
Great.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to give you some props. I found that most composers are not really good conductors and vice versa, but you do both. How do you balance both of those things?
Well, balance could be just knowledge about both crafts. It could also be balancing just the sheer schedule of maintaining those two.
Sure.
Yeah, I ride every day between 4 a.m. and 6 a.m., just without fault. So for me, it's a routine. And so the creativity is not something you just like turn on the weekends or whenever you have a few moments. Mm-hmm. It really has to be something that you, if you're serious about it, that you have a dedicated time to it every day. It's a discipline. And you find that when you do sit down, even though it's 4 a.m., that it's amazing how much thoughts come to mind, because your body and your mind is just so used to it. it's used to turning on at that time. And so you can,
and I imagine there's very little distraction.
There's no one's calling at that hour.
Right.
And you know, the day is fresh, and you're not mulling over what you didn't get done the day before and all that like you would in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
So I find it to be the best time to do it. And then the conducting part really feeds that, and vice versa. You know what works in rehearsal. And as a composer, you know what works in rehearsal. And as a conductor, you're looking back at the page. And so they both are mutually beneficial. So I've really, they're very symbiotic. That relationship is very tight.
Yin and yang
exactly.
Together. Influences on your composition. I found a lot about your conducting.
Two main influences, really. One is Cecil Effinger. He was an oboist at the University of Colorado. But the main one was Norman Lockwood. Norman Lockwood and Cecil Effinger both studied with Nadia Boulanger, who's the great French teacher. And so I studied with Norman for about 18 years. He was like a grandfather to me. His lessons were always on Sunday afternoon, and we would work for about an hour there at his piano, and he always smoked a pipe. He had, the tweed jacket, exactly what you would think of a composer. And then we would take a walk outside for a few minutes, and he had a little white house there in Denver, and then we would come back in, and Vona, his wife, would make tea, and then we would go back into the piano room and work some more. So it was just that same. The whole ordeal took about 2.5 hours, really. So, and he always took a special interest in me, and
if I'm not mistaken, Effinger, not a choral composer.
No, not at all. You're exactly right. But, there's a lot to be. I was an instrumentalist as well as a choral. And, again, it's that sort of that general knowledge about the two sides, which really aren't two at all. They're just one.
It's
all music, right? And so I think universities particularly try to separate even instrumental conducting, choral conducting, instrumental methods, choral methods. And I do think that that's negative because it is all one thing.
Exactly.
It just is. There should just be methods.
I'm pointing to our producer, Lucas. We were just talking before this interview how we want to do other things. We don't just want to do choir. We want to reach out and do other ensembles,
exactly.
Other opportunities.
It's a much richer experience.
Right. And I certainly teach that conducting is conducting. There's no difference between conducting a choir and an orchestra.
No,
and I think
at all.
Those times are kind of, the days of the choral conductors that just did big circles constantly. I think we finally come away from that.
I think you're right about that. Both of my composition teachers, Normand and Cecil Effinger, they were composers first. I mean, they didn't really favor the voices over the instrumental or orchestral. So they were really holistic, I think, in their approach. But I can show you to this day the marks in my music that their effect and what they taught me and how it's still being written into the music, that influence. So I really value that.
It's great to just show that we as musicians are always growing and always getting better and trying to make it better.
That's right.
How do you go about choosing your texts for your pieces?
That is a very difficult task. You can always choose there's always a body of texts, maybe 100, that everybody writes to. You know, a lot of your Sarah Teasdales and just a lot of Psalms, for instance. But to really find unique texts that have not been set or haven't been set but once or twice is tough.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes maybe out of a... It takes me about 80% of the time in a composition, in a commission, let's say, to find the text. About 80% of my work is finding the text and only 20% in writing it.
What are the sources that you use for
your text? I do the old method. I go to the library. What you see on Google is only about 5% of the poetry in print, and it's usually the hot poetry that they're trying
that
to promote.
That everybody reads.
Right, because they want to sell ads. Frankly, I mean, you go to that poem and you're surrounded by ads. If it's a poem that's really obscure, no one's going to look it up, then you're not going to. So that commercialism, I think, negatively affects our choice of poetry sometimes. So if you go into like Amor de mi alma is one piece that I wrote. And I went to Renaissance Spanish poetry in the library. And, you know, there's a whole section on it. And I spent the afternoon just perusing through poetry and translations, and that's what you have to do, you know. And so that's the investment of, and that makes you'd be surprised how many pearls there are there that just haven't made it to the surface yet, if you will.
You're talking, it's striking me that yes, most of the pieces I know of yours are not well-known texts.
No, they're
yet
not.
They're incredible texts.
They're beautiful texts.
They're really exciting or beautiful. But
I don't write my own texts except for on rare occasion, because I think writing poetry takes the same sort of craft, time, energy, education that writing music does, that architecture does, that. And so to say, well, anyone can write poetry is a bit of an overstatement. So I think there's so much master poetry out there that you would be hard-pressed to write your own, need to write your own. Now, I have written a few, maybe three or four in my... I have 180 published pieces, but I don't make it a matter of habit by any stretch.
Do you have any particular favorite poets or... sources that you use?
I think Garcilaso de la Vega is he's a Renaissance poet of the Spanish Golden Age. He's one of my very favorites. Certainly, everybody loves Sarah Teasdale.
I'm sure.
Of course. There's just a whole... Robert Frost. I've said a couple of his poems, and he's just an American favorite, of course.
Sure.
Again, everybody loves Frost. A lot of your Scottish poets, particularly Scottish and British, I'm really attracted to. So there's just the fountain of poetry is so huge that there's really no reason to write your own unless somebody's just doodling at the piano and comes up with an idea.
Right, or has
something. And we all do that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I would say 9 times out of 10, those works don't come out very well because the composer's not... a poet.
A composer's not a poet, yeah. And you know, for those that like to do that, then I think it's great. They have their right to do it. But
sure.
I think if they would explore some of the master poets, their writing would even be better because they'd be more inspired by it. There's more layers of complexity within a poem. There's
it
more that you can react to.
It sets the form that you're going to write.
Sets the form, yeah.
If you had to choose one, if you had to choose conducting or composing, which would it be?
Well, I would choose composing.
Would you?
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like that's your...
Right. I hope that
focus.
I don't ever have to do that. But,
no, me too.
Yeah, but that's my true love, I think, is sitting down. You know, I grew up on a ranch in New Mexico, and I'm used to being... It's a solitary life out there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm used to sitting in silence and just thinking. And you'd be surprised how much music comes through your head. It's there's no problem with thinking of tunes. The problem is sorting out the tunes, the one tune that you like among 50, you know. So, but it's because, you know, music is created on a canvas of silence, and one has to be in silence for that to start pouring onto the paper. But I think every human being has a great deal to give if they only get in a position where they can actually listen to what's in their head. It's incredible.
Listen to silence.
Listen to silence, yeah.
One of the main things you were here to do today was the conducting masterclass with the students that applied and mm-hmm. came in. We had 6 students this morning that you worked with. Talk to me about your philosophy. I enjoyed your work very much this morning. As we were walking in and preparing for this, I think he was right on the money with everything he said. You never said anything, don't do that, or never do that. You took what the students offered and just made it a little bit tighter. Talk to me a little bit about your philosophy of conducting and our role, and what do you think are the important things for us to tackle as conductors? What's our role in this whole?
I think to really try to recreate what the composer had in mind as much as we know. Obviously, if they're a living composer, they're number one in our age, so we share a common humanity in a time period in history where we understand the relationships that they may be drawing on. Whereas with Handel or Bach or Palestrina, you're not living in that time period of history. So we understand them, but not to the point that we might someone who's our own age and living presently. So our job is to try to, as the best we can, to sonically resurrect what those black and white, that page of just dry ink, and make it alive. And as conductors, we have to communicate with the audience, because if music, at the end of it all, if music doesn't communicate, then it's pointless. It's just craft. It's just simply working out a part writing exercise on the paper. At the end of it all, you have to be able to communicate to an audience your thoughts, the thoughts of the composer, and all of this chain has to make it all the way to the audience to be successful.
And we have to do that without making a sound.
It all has to
be silent.
It has to be
in
silent.
Our communication.
They say that 80% of communication is physical gesture, facial expression, and only 20% is the language. And that's why a political candidate, for instance, can get up and do a speech. We don't know whether they really believe, and most of the presidential candidates, there's a speechwriter anyway. Mm-hmm. They read it as they're hopping off the helicopter to make sure they have all the words pronounced correctly, that we don't know whether the candidate actually believes that or not, because we don't know them personally.
Right.
But the way they say it and their facial expression, their manner, tells us somehow, maybe wrongly at times, that they're honest, that they truly believe that, and they have our best interests in mind. Now, do they? Well, we hope so. But we're basing a lot about, because we don't know any of our national candidates personally. We only read about them and maybe what the pundits say about them. So it can be a really scary process.
Right. And we're going a lot on perception. What we see. I loved in the masterclass today how much you talked about engaging your face and mm-hmm. how this is really where the communication comes from. They're
it's
not
true.
Looking at our hands.
They're not.
They're looking in our face. And I find so often with my own conducting students, that's the last thing they think about.
Yeah, they're busy getting the patterns, which of course have to be there. It's your craft. It's like being able to spell words and being able to write complete sentences, but you cannot communicate with your neighbor. You only know the craft of putting English together, let's say, but you don't use that to communicate. It's just a craft, and so you've missed. You didn't take that final step that puts it all together and uses it to connect with another human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I
try to tell my students that's where the music becomes your own, when you've put your own personality mm-hmm. on it, when you have conviction and belief in what you're doing and you're showing that's when it's your piece. It's not somebody else's or not a recording that's laying around. It's yours. You've made that music. But and you have to put your personality on it.
Some people interpret one of my works, let's say, quite a bit differently than I did or I do. And I always lean back and go, well, isn't that great? Because they have every right to try to represent my work, but also their connection to the piece, to their audiences in the way that they think is best, so that they can it can be organic to them, it can be honest, and so there can be a kind of a tightrope there to see how much of your own personality as a conductor comes to play with trying to be really honest with the score and what that you think the composer intended. So it can be a bit of a tug of war at times.
Thinking earlier when we were talking about your compositional process of letting go of it, and you know, so you started, you've done all of the work, you found the text, and then at some point you have to say it's done.
It's done.
How do you get there?
And not then well.
And then not just letting go of it, and like you just said, letting somebody else do it in a way that you didn't really think about, but not storming the stage and telling the guy stop.
You know, sometimes it's better. Sometimes their interpretation, you lean back and go, well, I didn't really intend that, but now that I think about it, that's a great idea. And so...
That's great. Yeah, I love that you're open to that.
True.
That's terrific.
And you just lean back and then the next time you conduct your own piece, you integrate what someone else had just done with it, and you go, well, you know, that's a great idea. I think I'll steal their idea. So, yeah, music is fluid, and we all should be in this business together and not be territorial. We certainly want to be guardians of our craft and try to constantly push our horizons, our parameters. But I think we can do that in a very civil way and really honor our friends and other colleagues that are conducting across the country and composing. And there's room for everyone.
Absolutely. It's not a sport where we're beating each other.
It's true.
As we are all in this community all together. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to do this interview with us. I really enjoyed talking with you, and I look forward to hearing your next piece. What's on the burner now?
Well, I probably shouldn't say this, but I have a piece that is due on February 1st. Now, that is behind us. I am 35 days or so behind. Somehow, the creative processes don't care about deadlines, it seems like. I wish that they did, because then I would be a little more on time. So you'll find me the rest of the weekend really scurrying about, finding every available minute to write. In the middle of the weekend, after I leave this conference, I'm conducting the Beethoven Mass in C at Oklahoma State University on Saturday night. So that'll be a good interruption, but a little bit of an interruption in the process of having extra time. And
can you
like
tell us what it is?
What's that?
Can you tell us the title?
Well, it's a commission for a huge church in Houston. It's their 50th anniversary in May, so it's not like that you can put it off and tell them I didn't quite get it done. I'll get it
to
you next year.
Upset. Yeah,
yeah. Suddenly, the 50th anniversary becomes the 51st anniversary, which isn't quite as celebratory as the 50th. So it's one of those that you will get it done. So, yeah. So I feel quite confident. I'm just running a little on the behind side.
Well, we look forward to that coming out and all your future pieces. We'll keep an eye on that.
Well, thank you. I've really had a great time today. Thanks for the interview.
Absolutely. Thank you. And this has been Texas State Choirs Today. We'll be back with another interview before you know it. Thanks.